From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Since April 15th of this year, the group calling itself Extinction Rebellion has been leading actions all over London, bringing the city to a standstill. Tens of thousands of activists, spurred by a sense of urgency on climate change that their politicians are simply not feeling, have occupied major landmarks across the city. They have glued themselves to trains and other structures, to each other in blocking entrances. They've engaged in mass non-violent civil disobedience, blocking roads and bridges. They've donned colorful costumes, paraded with large puppets and banners, and done everything they can to push political elites to respond to our climate emergency. What impact has Extinction Rebellion had? And how long will it continue? And how can US activists replicate such climate activism? We go now to London to speak with Mateer Rahman, member of the political strategy and vision sensing teams for Extinction Rebellion. Welcome, Mateer.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you very much for the interview.
So give us an overview of what exactly has been happening since April 15th. I understand that there were four or five major landmarks across London, such as Marble Arch and Piccadilly Circus, that that activists decided to occupy, sort of like the Occupy movement that happened many years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's been planned for a few months now, exactly how to... There was a test occupation, you could say, or a test move in November when the declaration was made, the Extinction Rebellion declaration at Parliament Square at the end of October, and there was an occupation of five bridges there, and that was to test, in a way, the police response and how the strategy of non-violent direct action, how that would play out. And it was so successful in terms of that how people came to that, and then also set up lots of local groups, that it brought the energy to really build towards the April the 15th rebellion and the occupation of four sites, to really bring the strategy to into its fruition, which was there's a book called This Is an Uprising by Mark Engler, and a lot of the Extinction Rebellion strategy is based upon that, the theory of non-violent civil disobedience, which is set out in that book about how that actually creates social movements and social change.
So the activism, I understand, also took on some specific targets. For example, on Thursday, there was a focus on financial institutions and how they are enabling our climate catastrophe to continue. So activists glued themselves to one another, blocking off the London Stock Exchange, among other actions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I heard when you were introducing it about how New York or the US could replicate what happened in the UK. And the first stage, in a way, was to occupy these, or to occupy the roads at four sites that would have created that dilemma situation for the government, in a way, of blocking at Oxford Circus, at Waterloo Bridge, at Marble Arch, and Parliament Square. So four sites and four corners, which then created that economic disruption of sufficient level for the government then to have a dilemma as to whether to mass arrest everybody or to allow the economic disruption to happen. And then following on from those occupations, also to have these, as you say, these satellite actions as well to highlight specific issues, say with the transport or with also at the financial district as well. So to highlight how those are also complicit.
Now, I want to ask you a question that has been a sort of a weird side question, but I've been imagining what this must have felt like. People are gluing themselves to windows of trains, gluing themselves to one another using super glue. I imagine that the extrication is quite painful. This isn't the same as, you know, handcuffing oneself to somebody else. Gluing your skin. Tell me a little bit about that and how people are willing to risk their own sort of, you know, physical self in this climate emergency.
Yeah, I mean the actual liquid or to get it's only warm water and some sort of solvent, so it's not, it takes time to get it off slowly.
Ah.
But it's not as painful as it seems. I wish it was gluing one's hand to it, so long as it's not ripped off. But you know, so that's the point of it, to keep, to have that you're glued on, and the police to take those to take its public duties into account in terms of and how they extricate yourself from that situation.
So what has the police response been? I understand that, you know, there've been over 1,000 arrests. I imagine that the number is really climbing every day, and it's the largest number of arrests in London around a single set of actions ever.
Yeah, I mean, I can't compare it to, say, for example, in with Gandhi or India or how those times, but in modern times, I think it's one of the largest numbers of arrests for non-violent civil disobedience. And that is part of the theory that Roger Hallam, who was one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, he was doing his research on a PhD, looking at how non-violent civil disobedience has led to social change. And one of the factors was the number of arrests and the amount of public support that is behind that. And so those are two key factors to create that change. And so we've had over 1,000 arrests. The police response has been, we've been very transparent with the police to tell them, you know, what we're doing. We've been transparent with the emergency services so that they can create alternative routes, so not to put lives in danger. So that is a huge part of the movement of non-violence, that we are very open with the police. And I think, because I've been in communication with some, a little bit with the international movement, and there have been different, in different countries, there are different senses of how to respond and interact with the police. Each country has a different reaction to that.
Right, I should mention that this is an international movement, although its epicenter is in London, and its birthplace, I understand, has been in London. What sort of people have come out? Because of course, as is the case in any such mass action, you have your core organizers, and then you have members of the general public who are mobilized, who find out about it, who feel so moved that they come out. I mean, photographs and videos from London show people of all ages participating. So can you give us a sense of who has been part of this movement?
I mean, I came to this movement after taking part in the a huge part of the culture is a regenerative culture as well, of bringing into the groups who take part in super gluing themselves, etc. That there are members in their group that look after the regenerative aspects, making sure that there's somebody with them that goes to the police station. And the organizing of Extinction Rebellion has been very open as well. So it's decentralized. So new people can join in and take part in groups that are emerging and forming. So there are three main groups, you could say. There's the movement strategy, the action strategy, and the political strategy. And then within those, more circles like media and messaging, etc., that people can take part in. And I actually set up a Facebook, a Muslim Extinction Rebellion Facebook group, and I joined because I felt there was some, as being a Muslim as well, that there was a need for a positive contribution that Muslims could provide to the narrative of climate extinction and climate collapse. Mm. There are, as you say, more and more people from different sectors coming across. It's not just a middle class movement. It is to be a movement that is a social movement that meets everybody and marginalized people as well as with sort of the typical climate activist, you could say.
Speaking of Muslims, London has its first Muslim mayor. How has Sadiq Khan been responding to what's happened in his city?
Well, the London Assembly was one of the first local government bodies to pass a motion for a climate and ecological emergency, a declaration of climate and ecological emergency. There have been now over 70 local authorities which have declared a climate and ecological emergency, calling on the central government to release the funds to enable them to act on those declarations. And since the actual rebellion, there has been some, I mean, Sadiq Khan, of course, he's got his role with transport as well, so he has to, he wasn't so keen on the actions against Transport for London with the underground. But there, I would say generally there's been a positive sense from the London Assembly as to the reasons why these actions have been taken.
And by the way, I should mention there are now reports that a new Banksy art piece appeared in London as part of Extinction Rebellion. An image of a young girl holding up a sign with the symbol of it, or actually looks like she's planting a seedling into the ground. And the caption says, "From this moment, despair ends and tactics begin." How successful have these actions been so far? I understand that among the occupations that have been held was one that took place in front of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Have MPs been moving? Have people been acknowledging the extent of the crisis? The Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, I understand, spoke to MPs as well during this whole series of actions. Have they shown a changing of their minds and shown some sense that they need to be taking this as seriously as you are?
I think there's definitely been a shift over the 2 weeks when the media was first reporting that it was more, who are you to disrupting ordinary people's lives? And then about halfway, as actually people began to see how the non-violence was at the heart of it and how creative the actions were, more and more people were joining in. The messaging began to change, and with Greta Thunberg particularly supporting Extinction Rebellion and seeing some of the leaders of the major political parties, there was that also created a huge shift. So Michael Gove, who's the Secretary of State for the Environment, has now agreed to meet with Extinction Rebellion next week, and there have been a lot of MPs actually have been coming out on they came out on the Marble Arch stage. A few MPs came out onto that stage to declare their support. Some of the rebels went into Parliament to talk to their MPs, which was amazing to see that this space was being opened up in a way. And MPs, I think, liked to see their constituents. So that has created a change. There's been, I think, that kind of almost a tipping point into a place where we've opened up a space now where this conversation can actually can be had around climate, the actual emergency, and people and MPs and the media are beginning to take this seriously, as well as the business as well. So the CBI recently launched a business rebels or business declares an emergency platform as well. So this is having effect across multiple platforms.
Let's talk about the demands of Extinction Rebellion. There's just three, and they're very clear. And just as an aside, I remember during the time of the Occupy Wall Street movements here in the US, there was a little bit of a resistance to articulate clearly and simply and concisely a set of demands. But Extinction Rebellion has demanded that governments tell the truth about the ecological crisis, that you want zero emissions and draw down by 2025. That's just over 5 years from now. And participatory democracy, setting up of a sort of assembly. Can you tell me a little bit about, the first one is clear, telling the truth about the ecological crisis, but this demand for zero emissions and drawdown by 2025, some would say is very radical and we can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's net zero by 2025. And that's an ambitious target. Yes, everyone would agree that's an ambitious target. But we have to go as ambitious as we can. And then if there's some, the Citizens Assembly is the key aspect, because that's the platform or the place at which these decisions will be made. So that rather than MPs making the decisions, it is a tried and tested method of a representative body of citizens selected by random selection rather than voting for them, and to reflect the demographics of the country, and then for that body to be making decisions. And that's what was used in Ireland, for example, when there was the question of the lifting of the ban on abortion, which was a very hot topic and no MP wanted to touch it. And then through the use of a citizens' assembly to come to a decision of deliberative democracy. So they were the, a bit like a grand jury, but much bigger, 100 people or so, randomly selected. And they would then bring in the experts to answer particular questions, but they would remain with the mandate and the authority to make the final decision. And that mandate was trusted by the people because it was a randomly selected body. And so that democratic innovation, we think, is absolutely key and crucial to making the transition to a net zero carbon future.
So there is this sense that climate activists, of course, feel... from attending the UN conferences, the COP meetings, that even if governments and political elites take seriously the emergency that we face, that the outcome ends up always being a plan to make a plan to someday reduce emissions. That's not enough, isn't it? Some among the messages that Extinction Rebellion has been making clear is that we have 12 years to turn this around, and others say even less time. It's past time to make a plan to make a plan, right?
Definitely, definitely. No, yeah, it's just that report from the IPCC, the 1.5 degrees report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in October 2018 was a wake-up call that we have this short window in which to make the change. And when you think of it, if you think of it like, you know, we're on a trajectory, this to climate collapse, you can almost see it as we need an emergency break to change the trajectory to one where life can sustain itself, or the potential for it to sustain itself at least can be enlarged. And it's that emergency break period which is absolutely key. And Christiana Figueres, I don't know, she recently came out of support. There's a YouTube video of her. She was the leader of the talks in Paris for the UN. And she's now come out in support of Extinction Rebellion, saying that that it's done a much needed task of bringing the message of the urgency to a wider audience, and that it's now a political commitment that needs to happen to make this happen across the world. And that's what the Extinction Rebellion has tried to start and kickstart through its global and international movement. Mm-hmm. And we've got 30, I think it was 80 cities, over 30 countries which have taken action.
Although it doesn't seem as though the actions have been as news-breaking and radical and mass and at a mass level as they have been in London. So I want to ask you what advice you would give to those of us here in the United States, the wealthiest country in the world, the country that is the biggest country to have pulled out of the very modest and flawed Paris Accord, whose leader is intent on unleashing more fossil fuels in the world. What advice would you give? I mean, you have the advantage in London of living in a sort of a densely populated city where you can have a strategy like the one you did, but that wouldn't apply to, say, a city like Los Angeles, where we are based, right? I mean, you can do it on a local level, but to get the attention of politicians like Londoners have, what advice would you give?
Yeah, I mean, we have in England the privilege of living in a country where democracy does actually work, and where non-violence. We have the right to peaceful protest, and that is taken seriously. So people can superglue themselves to trains or block roads, and expect the police to respond in a proportionate way. And I'm sure there are many other countries where that wouldn't necessarily happen. So they have to, you have to take into account those cultural and legal differences as well. And I guess in the States they do. You have similar laws. But at the heart of that is bringing this non-violence, that DNA, you could say, of how to feel it, to be it, to know that non-violence, satyagraha, that truth-telling and holding that one is willing to hold that sense and bring the government to bear on them. And the local groups as well was really key, of having many local groups set up since the November action, and to strengthen their local groups, the affinity groups, and to strengthen that ground base of support as well. So it may mean that other countries might take a little longer, but we're hoping that other countries will come to the same place that we have in England as well, and we can strengthen each other in supporting each other to come to that. So this is just the first stage of a long, long struggle, you could say, because it is a huge struggle to bring to make this huge shift. And we've done the first step of bringing awareness to it. But now, as you say, it's about not just making another plan, it's about enacting the huge radical shifts that we are going to need to be able to survive together.
Right. And I want to, by the way, mention the book that you were talking about earlier by Mark Engler, This Is an Uprising. We had interviewed Mark about that book in 2016, and we'll link to that interview from the post where we put your interview on our website so that people can listen to that broader idea that has informed the work that you've done. Thank you so much for joining us today. And give out a website for Extinction Rebellion.
It's rebellion.earth.
That's rebellion.earth. Simple, really. Thank you so much for joining us, Mutir.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My guest has been Mutir Rahman, member of the political strategy and vision sensing teams for Extinction Rebellion. We've been discussing how XR has brought London to a standstill over the climate emergency. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.